the same arrows, the same chariot drawn by the same horses. And I used them as the same Arjun to whom all the kings offered their due respects. But in the absence of Lord Krishna, all of them at a moment's notice have become null and void. And then Srimad Bhagavatam 1:15:27. Now I am attracted to those instructions imparted to me by the personality of Godhead, because they are impregnated with instructions for relieving the burning heart in all circumstances of time and space. So those instructions he's talking about are the instructions Krishna gave in Bhagavad Gita. And then Srila Prabhupada in a letter in 73 said, the instruction given in my books is supposed to be personal instruction. When we read Bhagavad Gita as it is understood that we are receiving personal instructions from Krishna. No physical barrier is there in the case of spiritual affairs. So when we're talking siksha, there is no boundaries of time or space. The siksha, even 10,000 years from now, will be accessible to us as personal instruction. Just I found those words very encouraging and wanted to share them with you. On the board today, I've written the question bank for chapter 6, and I've also given you some ideas, some examples of Mudan Mission purports. They're not exclusive. You may find others that are more appealing to you, inspire you more, that's fine. These are basically just to give you some kind of a guideline. Prashantra is back in Vrindavan. She'll be coming straight after Bhagavad Gita class, and then you'll be able to discuss what to do about the exams and that kind of thing. Okay, so today we'll be concluding our study at this point in time of chapter 6. Verses 37 to 45 are a result of Arjun hearing from Krishna about the mechanical severity of the Ashtanga Yoga process. He can now understand that this path is not only very difficult, but there are many obstacles on the path. And he logically concludes that many practitioners probably don't achieve the ultimate success. And so his next question is, what happens to those that fail? Very logical, intelligent question. The path is difficult. Okay, that means everybody's not going to be successful in following it. So what happens to those who fail? This question is expressed quite elaborately in verses 37 and 38. We can understand that Arjuna has actually thought quite a bit about this matter and is now revealing his mind to Krishna. So let's read these verses as well as some of the purports of Prabhupada's commentary. So in verses 37-38, Arjuna is saying, O Krishna, what is the destination of the unsuccessful transcendentalist who in the beginning takes to the process of self-realization with faith, but who later desists due to worldly mindedness and thus does not attain perfection in mysticism? Then in 38, O mighty armed Krishna, does not such a man who is bewildered from the path of transcendence fall away from both spiritual and material success and perish like a riven cloud with no position in any sphere? So let's have a look at the purport of 38 from the beginning. There are two ways to progress. Those who are materialists have no interest in transcendence. Therefore, they are more interested in material advancement by economic development or in promotion to the higher planets by appropriate work. When one takes to the path of transcendence, one has to cease all material activities and sacrifice all forms of so-called material happiness. If the aspiring transcendentalist fails, then he apparently loses both ways. In other words, he can enjoy neither material happiness nor spiritual success. So we can understand that Arjuna is feeling some concern. If you practice devotional service and you're successful, fine, the spiritual result is attained. But if you've given up all material endeavor for that and you're not successful, then where do you stand? Verse 39 is a very interesting verse. Here Arjuna is reconfirming his faith in Krishna directly to Krishna. He wants Krishna to know that he trusts him, knows him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and wants only him to answer his doubt, because after all, he is the ultimate authority. We can learn something about personal dealings between guru and disciple from this verse. If we have strong faith in guru and express that simply and sincerely to him, obviously he's going to be more inclined to give us his time, reveal more to us, and engage us in the service of his Guru Maharaj's mission. Verse 40 to 45 are Krishna's answer to Arjuna's questions, which we've just heard in verse 37-38. In essence, these verses are an elaboration on Bhagavad Gita 2.40. In fact, 2.40 and 6.40 are very similar in message. In 2.40 we hear from Krishna, "In this endeavor there is no loss or diminution, and a little advancement on the path can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear." And then in 6.40, Krishna says, "O son of Pritha, a transcendentalist engaged in auspicious activities does not meet with destruction, either in this world or in the spiritual world. One who does good, my friend, is never overcome by evil." I'd like to read a little of Prabhupada's purport to 6.40. I think you'll find it very interesting. We'll begin about 8 lines down from the verse quoted from Srimad Bhagavatam. "One may argue that by Krishna consciousness one may attain the highest perfection if it is completed. But if one does not attain such a perfection or stage, then he loses both materially and spiritually. It is enjoined in the scriptures that one has to suffer the reaction for not executing prescribed duties. Therefore, one who fails to discharge transcendental activities properly becomes subjected to these reactions. The Bhagavatam assures the unsuccessful transcendentalist that there need be no worries. Even though he may be subjected to the reaction for not perfectly executing prescribed duties, he is still not a loser, because auspicious Krishna consciousness is never forgotten, and one so engaged will continue to be so even if he is lowborn in the next life. On the other hand, one who simply follows strictly the prescribed duties need not necessarily attain auspicious results if he is lacking in Krishna consciousness." So here, Prabhupada is very expertly prodding the heart. He's checking, what is our attachment? What do we see as auspiciousness? Here he's saying that even if we have to suffer the reaction of not performing our prescribed duties perfectly, still we won't lose our Krishna consciousness. But how do we feel about that? Are we still on the platform of trying to avoid pain and attain happiness? Do we still see auspiciousness in that light? Auspicious means it's good for, I'm enjoying. Inauspicious means I'm not. Just something to think about. Prabhupada is making it quite clear here that true auspiciousness is whatever external condition of life we're in, we are remembering Krishna and engaging in Krishna consciousness. It's an interesting point. Then if we have a look about 10 or 11 lines from the bottom of the purport, another interesting point. "Any activity which is not aimed at ultimate self-realization or liberation from the material bodily concept of life is not at all auspicious. Activity in Krishna consciousness is the only auspicious activity. And anyone who voluntarily accepts all bodily discomforts for the sake of making progress on the path of Krishna consciousness can be called a perfect transcendentalist under severe austerity. And because the Eightfold Yoga system is directed toward the ultimate realization of Krishna consciousness, such practice is also auspicious. And no one who is trying his best in this matter need fear degradation." Basically a follow-on from what we've just been saying. One point I'd like to share with you at this point in time, which is a follow-on basically from what I've just said, is that it's our faith in Krishna and the process that makes for auspiciousness. It's not externals. It's our faith. Our faith in Guru, our faith in the process, our faith in Krishna. That is what makes things auspicious. So often, we find that things look very inauspicious. That's not unusual. After all, it is Kali Yuga. But if we just trust in Prabhupada, in Krishna, and in the process, everything will work out in our best interests. Of course, that faith shouldn't be blind, and it shouldn't be passive. It's best if we carefully and Krishna consciously think things through and then act dynamically in Krishna consciousness. I'm making a difference here between passionately and dynamically. In Nectar of Instruction, Rupa Goswami defines utsaha or enthusiasm as working with enthusiasm in Krishna consciousness, using our intelligence in Krishna consciousness. So I'm saying basically that auspiciousness is a state of consciousness. What is auspicious or not auspicious is actually a state of consciousness. The most inauspicious circumstance can become glorious. We saw that in Europe, in Germany in particular, when there was an attempt to ban book distribution, make book distribution illegal. And the response, there was a similar thing happened in Australia. The two cases were dealt with extremely differently. But in Germany, the reaction of the management at that time, okay, we'll go to court, we'll take it to court. Every day, the devotees led Harinam to the court. They distributed prasadam throughout the court. And books. They presented Prabhupada's books as evidence, and they won the case. So this is an indication of faith in Krishna, faith in Prabhupada, faith in the process. I'd like to share you a Vedic story. You may have heard it before, but it really indicates how when we have faith in the process, and that is matched with a dynamism in the terms of a determination and intelligence, then we can overcome what appears to be even the most inauspicious circumstance. So this is the story of Savitri and Satyavan. Savitri was the daughter of a great king. And when it was time for her to marry, she chose to marry a person called Satyavan. But this Satyavan, he was blind. His father was blind. And he had been exiled to the forest. He'd lost his kingdom, everything. And Satyavan was actually cursed to die within a year. But still the girl, for some reason, had a very strong desire to marry him. And even though Narad Muni was there and advising, this is not a good idea, this man is going to die in a year, she said, no, this, I feel very strongly this is the person I should marry, and she decided to do it. So the marriage took place. 3 days before the destined day, the day that the husband was supposed to die, she began to fast. And on the fateful day, she begged Satyavan to take her with him into the forest. As they were walking, Satyavan suddenly fell down to the ground dead. Yamaraj then came to take his soul, and Savitri followed. Yamaraj told her to go back, but she said, "It is said that when two persons take 7 steps together, they become friends. I've walked more than 7 steps with you." She then spoke on morality, and Yamaraj was very pleased. Yamaraj said, "You are very wise in the scriptures. Ask for any boon from me except your dead husband's life." Savitri said, "Please give my father-in-law his sight and make him very strong." Again she followed, and again Yama was pleased with her. So he said, he would give her another boon. Savitri said, "Give my father-in-law back his kingdom." Again she spoke of morality, and he granted her two more boons. "Savitri, grant my father some sons and grant me 100 sons." Yamaraj saw that she was still waiting. He said, "I've given you so many boons. Why are you waiting?" Savitri said, "I'm a chaste wife. How can I have sons if my husband is dead?" So Yamaraj said, "Your devotion is unequaled. Your determination is unparalleled. I give you back your husband's life." So we can see, very powerful, this faith in the process and faith in the goal and determination. If we can have this kind of intelligent, determined faith in Guru and Krishna, then I'm sure transcendental success in this life is guaranteed. So Krishna, having cleared Arjuna's fears that a fallen soul loses everything, both materially and spiritually, he goes on to explain the two levels of destination. This he begins in verse 41. Here he's talking about someone who falls down from the devotional or the transcendental path after a short practice. I'd like to have a look at what both he and Prabhupada have to say. Let's open up at 41 of chapter 6. So yesterday I started to speak about these verses for some reason while I was giving class. I was meditating on them and I started to verbalize. But I was just saying, these verses really charm my heart, actually, because they're just so much of an indication of how much Krishna cares. You know, like most people, when you're a failure, they don't like you too much. They tend to reject you. It's fashion, and it's a hip to like someone who's successful, you know, has money, has position, who's appreciated socially. But not too many people, except a very dear friend, will stay with you when everybody else is saying you're off the planet and you know, you've got nothing to your name. So Krishna is such a dear friend. And even though these personalities who have practiced the transcendental process have become enamored again by the material energy, which means, in fact, that they've turned their back on him. Silly is making such amazing arrangements for them. And in particular, I found in this a very strong lesson for us as devotees. How do we treat devotees who are going through difficulty? Just a point to think about. Do we follow in Krishna's footsteps, or do we follow in the footsteps of the materialists? So in verse 41, Krishna is saying, "The unsuccessful yogi, after many, many years of enjoyment on the planets of the pious living entities, is born into a family of righteous people or into a family of rich aristocracy." In the Bhaktivedanta Purport, we hear, right from the beginning we'll start, "The unsuccessful yogis are divided into two classes. One is fallen after very little progress and one is fallen after long practice of yoga. The yogi who falls after a short period of practice goes to the higher planets, where pious living entities are allowed to enter. After prolonged life there, one is sent back again to this planet to take birth in the family of a righteous Brahmana Vaishnava or of aristocratic merchants. The real purpose of Krishna conscious practice is to achieve the highest perfection of Krishna consciousness, as explained in the last verse of this chapter. But those who do not persevere to such an extent and who fail because of material allurements are allowed, by the grace of the Lord, to make full utilization of their material propensities." Isn't that amazing? They've fallen away from the path because of material desire. So Krishna is giving them full facility to burn out those material desires by actually fulfilling them, and then giving them another chance by taking a very good birth. And after that, they are given opportunities to live prosperous lives in righteous or aristocratic families. Those who are born in such families may take advantage of the facilities and try to elevate themselves to full Krishna consciousness. And in verses 42 to 45, Krishna goes to quite some extent to explain what happens when someone falls after a long time. you can feel almost a feeling, there's like a feeling of remorseful compassion that his dear soul, his dear part and parcel, has endeavored for such a long time and still fallen. So you can feel a special compassion of Krishna manifest in his words here and in the fact that he's made a very special arrangement for him. So here we're reading of a very rare birth and a very superior birth. Let's have a look at what is the process. Here it's not just that Krishna places him in a favorable circumstance for practicing devotional service, but also he has certain samskaras, certain conditionings which propel him to begin his spiritual practice right from childhood. So let's have a look at these verses, 42 to 45, and Srila Prabhupada's purports. We'll read the verses first, or maybe we'll read verse then purport, just relevant points. So 42, or if unsuccessful after long practice of yoga, he takes his birth in a family of transcendentalists or surely great in wisdom. Certainly such a birth is rare in this world. Then in the purport, birth in the family of yogis or transcendentalists, those with great wisdom, it praised herein, because a child born in such a family receives a spiritual impetus from the very beginning of his life. It is especially the case in the Acharya or Goswami families. Then about four lines down, by the grace of the Lord, there are still families that foster transcendentalists generation after generation. It's certainly very fortunate to take birth in such families. Fortunately, both our spiritual master, Om Vishnupad Sri Srimad Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Goswami Maharaj, and our humble self had the opportunity to take birth in such families by the grace of the Lord. And both of us were trained in the devotional service of the Lord from the very beginning of our lives. Later on, we met by the order of the transcendental system. I found this a very sweet comment by Srila Prabhupada. He's sort of putting himself in the position of a fallen transcendentalist and saying, by good fortune, the mercy of Krishna, I was able to have a higher birth this time. Of course, we know a different Prabhupada than the Prabhupada that he is suggesting here. Then in 43, Krishna says, on taking such a birth, he revives the divine consciousness of his previous life, and he again tries to make further progress in order to achieve complete success, O son of Kuru. This purport is very interesting and gives a very, very good example of this. So I'd like to read the whole purport. King Bharat, who took his third birth in the family of a good Brahmana, this is his third birth, right? Not second, third. He is an example of good birth for the revival of previous Krishna transcendental consciousness. King Bharat was the emperor of the world, and since his time, this planet has been known among the demigods as Bharatvarsha. Formerly, it was known as Ilavritta-vasha. The emperor, at an early age, retired for spiritual perfection, but failed to achieve success. In his next life, he took birth in the family of a good Brahmana and was known as Jatabharat, because he always remained secluded and did not talk to anyone. And later on, he was discovered as the greatest transcendentalist by King Rahugana. From his life, it is understood the transcendental endeavors or the practice of yoga never go in vain. By the grace of the Lord, the transcendentalist gets repeated opportunities for complete perfection in Krishna consciousness. Verse 44, by virtue of the divine consciousness of his previous life, he automatically becomes attracted to the yogic principles, even without seeking them. Such an inquisitive transcendentalist stands always above the ritualistic principles of the scriptures. So I found this an interesting point for those who deal with bhaktins or bhaktas and those who deal with children who are born in the movement. Is their lack of interest in the ritual of Krishna consciousness a sign of maya or a sign of advancement? Prabhupada says in the purport, advanced yogis are not very much attracted to the rituals of the scriptures, but they automatically become attracted to the yoga principles, which can elevate them to complete Krishna consciousness, the highest yoga perfection. In other words, they're after the essence. They're attracted to the essence. They may not have much interest in other, you know, like what we are interested in, you know, like different aspects of the ritual and the process. Their intelligence is very fixed on the essence of what they're doing. 45. And when the yogi engages himself with sincere endeavor in making further progress, being washed of all contaminations, then ultimately achieving perfection after many, many bursts of practice, he attains the supreme goal. Prabhupada, in the beginning of the purport, says, a person born in a particularly righteous, aristocratic, or sacred family becomes conscious of his favorable condition for executing yoga practice. With determination, therefore, he begins his unfinished task, and thus he completely cleanses himself of all material contaminations. When he is finally free from all contaminations, he attains the supreme perfection, Krishna consciousness. Now I'd like to say something about this, which Jagadish Maharaj made as a very strong point many years ago. It's a very good point. It's that these personalities who have really refined their Krishna consciousness, they're quite a purified state of consciousness, but then they're tricked somehow and they fall down. When they take birth again, the anattas that are in the heart are very, very prominent. They're the final little dregs of materialistic thought and conception are there. You find sometimes with our children that there are just, you know, there are some things that drive you crazy about them. You know, in general, they're very sweet people, but there's just certain characteristics of personality that are very, very prominent and really very testing for us who have to deal with them. So we can understand that these children that are coming in the movement, they are not coming, you know, some of them may be coming from the spiritual world, but many of them are coming from a position of being very purified, very elevated in consciousness, but then the mind becomes fixed on some aspect of the material energy and it drags them down. So whatever it is that was fixed on at that time, or many things perhaps, it will become a prominent part of the consciousness that they're dealing with, that they have to purify in this life. So we find that there's sometimes very strong personality traits there that we can understand there are anattas to be dealt with. We may even find it in ourselves. Just a point that I found interesting. Verses 46 and 47 are Krishna's conclusion to Arjuna about Ashtanga Yoga. In essence, he tells him that Bhakti Yoga is the perfection of yoga, and he explains the prominent qualities of such a perfect yogi. I want to read both these verses and quite a large section of Prabhupada's purport to verse 47. It's a very clear understanding of the yoga ladder. And on Monday, we'll be looking at theme 5A, which is the yoga processes. If you know this section of the purport, you'll be able to very clearly deal with this theme. It's a very, very clear statement of what we're dealing with. So let's have a look. This is 46-47. Krishna is saying, a yogi is greater than the ascetic, greater than the empiricist, and greater than the fruited worker. Therefore, O Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. In 47, and of all yogis, the one with great faith, who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga, and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. Now I'd like to start reading the purport from the beginning of the third paragraph. It begins the culmination of all kinds of yoga practices. It's a very nice and very clear understanding of the yoga ladder. The culmination of all kinds of yoga practices lies in bhakti yoga. All other yogas are but means to come to the point of bhakti in bhakti yoga. Yoga actually means bhakti yoga. All other yogas are progressions toward the destination of bhakti yoga. From the beginning of Karma Yoga to the end of Bhakti Yoga is a long way to self-realization. Karma Yoga without fruitive results is the beginning of this path. When Karma Yoga increases in knowledge and renunciation, the stage is called Gyan Yoga. When Gyan Yoga increases in meditation on the Supersoul by different physical processes and the mind is on Him, it is called Astanga Yoga. And when one surpasses the Astanga Yoga and comes to the point of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, it is called Bhakti Yoga, the culmination. Factually, Bhakti Yoga is the ultimate goal. But to analyze Bhakti Yoga minutely, one has to understand these other yogas. The yogi who is progressive is therefore on the true path of eternal good fortune. One who sticks to a particular point and does not make further progress is called by that particular name: Karma Yogi, Jnana Yogi, or Dhyan Yogi, Raja Yogi, Artha Yogi, etc. If one is fortunate enough to come to the point of Bhakti Yoga, it is to be understood that he has surpassed all other yogas. Therefore, to become Krishna conscious is the highest stage of yoga. Just as when we speak of Himalayan, we refer to the world's highest mountains, of which the highest peak, Mount Everest, is considered to be the culmination. It is by great fortune that one comes to Krishna consciousness on the path of Bhakti Yoga, to become well situated according to the Vedic direction. The ideal yogi concentrates his attention on Krishna, who is called Shyamasunda, who is as beautifully colored as a cloud, whose lotus-like face is as effulgent as the sun, whose dress is brilliant with jewels, and whose body is flower garlanded. Illuminating all sides is his gorgeous luster, which is called the Brahma Jyoti. He incarnates in different forms as Ram, Narsingha, Varaha, and Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he descends like a human being, as a son of Mother Yashoda, and he is known as Krishna, Govinda, and Vasudev. He is the perfect child, husband, friend, and master, and he is full with all opulence and transcendental qualities. If one remains fully conscious of these features of the Lord, he is called the highest yogi. Srila Prabhupada gives a very nice elaboration on this 47th verse in a lecture he gave in Los Angeles in 69. I found it very instructive in terms of refining our consciousness as well as our activities in Krishna consciousness. So when we speak of worship, there is motive. But when we speak of service, there is no motive. Service is love. Just like mother renders service to the child, there is no motive. It is love only. Everyone can neglect the child, but the mother cannot, because there is love. Similarly, Bhaj Dhatu, where there is question of service, there is no question of motive. That is the perfection of Krishna consciousness. Just like we have seen many times the example, there is a staircase. You have to go to the highest floor, which is, say, the 100th floor. So somebody is on the 50th floor, somebody is on the 30th floor, somebody is on the 80th floor. So if by coming to the particular 80th, 50th, or 30th floor, one thinks this is finished, then he's not progressing. One has to go to the end. That is the highest platform of yoga. The whole staircase can be called a yoga system, connecting, linking. But don't be satisfied by keeping yourself on the 50th floor or the 80th floor. Go to the highest platform, the 100th floor. That is Bhakti Yoga. Now, if somebody, instead of crossing the steps, he is given a chance to take an elevator, within a second he comes to the top. So if someone says, "Why? Shall I take advantage of this elevator? I shall go step by step." He can do that, but there is a chance of fall down. If you take this Bhakti Yoga, immediately you take the help of the elevator, and within a second, you're on the 100th floor. This is a process, direct process. You can go step by step, following all the yoga processes, but you can take directly also. Lord Chaitanya has recommended that in this age, people are very short living. They are disturbed. They are full of anxiety. Therefore, by His grace, by His causeless mercy, He is giving you the lift. Immediately come to Bhakti Yoga simply by chanting Hare Krishna. Immediately come. There's a lot of nice points in this lecture given by Prabhupada. One thing that really struck me is that even though we are practicing Krishna consciousness, sadhana bhakti, it's important to remember it doesn't mean we have attained the 100th step. Not that we can think, now I'm involved in the process, you know, everything's fine. We have to be constantly endeavoring to refine our understanding of what we're doing, our practice of what we're doing, our culture, how we're living the culture, all of these things. So it's never that we can, even in the spiritual sky, everyone is always endeavoring to love Krishna more, to please Krishna more. I also found this point of there being no motive a very interesting one. It's very common to hear in ISKCON at this point in time. I gave my life, my youth, my money, everything to ISKCON, and now I have nothing. So what kind of consciousness is indicated here? It's something we can think about. So, of course, consciousness is shaped by training or lack of it, so that also has to be taken into consideration. But the point of coming to devotional service is not to come with a feeling that I'm going to gain anything materially, but rather that I'm wanting to develop my love for Krishna. I'm wanting to go back to him. So, just a thought. Any questions or comments? You don't think Krishna did? Anybody want to make a comment in relation to this? So he manages his traveling through. He has some pension coming in. Parvati, when we have some ability to hear you. One thing that I feel quite I have strong thoughts about is that I feel that we can't act on an artificial platform. To do it is very, very dangerous. So in the early period of ISKCON, there was a tendency to encourage everybody. In some countries it's still going on, Russia for example, or the old Russia. But there's a tendency to sort of encourage everybody to join the temple. That was the mood. If you didn't join the temple, you're in mine. So, but a lot of people aren't suited for full-time temple life. So personally, I don't have any problem with people making an honest decision now and thinking that this full-time temple life is not for me. You know, I much prefer to go out and find myself another situation and resituate myself, having looked very clearly at my circumstance, my consciousness, how I can practice Krishna consciousness favorably. You know, I'd be put myself more in the position of a Namhat member or whatever. I personally think that takes a lot of strength of character to go against social opinion or whatever it is and just say, okay, I have to take responsibility for my own Krishna consciousness, my own dedication to Prabhupada and his mission. How am I going to live my life in relation to that? It may manifest in many different ways. Some may find that full-time temple life is best for them. Others may find that it's better to step out of that, have their own financial base, and practice as a Namhat devotee. In Bengal, some of our Namhat devotees are in consciousness and in practice even, very, very elevated and quite often of a higher standard than those living in the temple. This is another point where lack of culture becomes a problem because we don't really have any guidelines of how to deal with old age and death Krishna consciousness, especially old age. You see that many devotees are becoming very worried, very disturbed, and they're starting to fall back on old patterns. They fall back on the old patterns because there's no Krishna conscious patterns that they're aware of that they can follow. Yeah, I very strongly agree with what you're saying, that really it is a matter of education and the understanding that would come from that. For example, when this is something that was very protective for me, because I've also experienced my ups and downs in ISKCON, but I've seen them as part of my path, you know, to perfection. But there's one section of Bhagavatam that has helped me over many, many difficulties, not only of my own, but of observing others going through difficulty. And that is when Parikshit Maharaj approaches Dharma in the form of a bull. And he's you know, like in a very bad shape. He's been attacked by Kali. So Parikshit Maharaj says, "Who has done this to you?" And the bull, of course, is Dharma. So he says, he gives the Shastric conclusion, to identify the perpetrator of what has been done to me is to receive the same destination as the person who did it. So this is a very deep point, and one of the points of education that we're not becoming conversant with, is that there is that element there that we have things to deal with in Prarabdha Karma. This body that we're wearing now has a certain path it has to follow before it drops, isn't it? Everything else will be burnt up. Everything else, if we're practicing Krishna consciously appropriately, all of the other karma will be burnt up. The ignorance will be burnt up. But we have to wear this. We have to go through with this. So, and karma isn't inflicted by dead matter. It's inflicted by other living entities. So if we start to see that person as the doer, and we start to interact with the person as the doer, then that karma goes into a whole new lifespan. We're creating a whole new field of activity for ourselves, another birth, so many things. So I very much appreciate your point that there is a need for introspection, Shastric introspection. And, you know, like, even though it's difficult, very difficult at times, to have more faith in Shastra than in your own mind, but if we can practice it and become strong in it, we start to see, yeah, this is the right way. And then regardless of the externals, so many crazy things can happen externally. You know, regardless of the externals, we can maintain some level of Krishna consciousness and go on with the process. But if our whole consciousness is directed outwards, externalized, then it's only going to be a matter of time before we fall down. It's only going to be a matter of time. The other point is that... The other point is that actually we all die alone. The other point is that actually we all die alone. Like, the environment externally may be very nice, may be very Krishna conscious, but what's going on inside? Where are we inside? What's happening there? You know? Dying is not an external thing so much as an internal. How are we dealing with that? Okay. Okay, we have a few thoughts to think about. I'll say one thing in conclusion. And that is that a very good prayer to pray every day is that you die a Krishna conscious death. Ananda was talking about, you know, we're getting older, we have to start thinking about these things. But if that prayer is on your prayer list every day, I think it would be quite a good move. Because basically we get what we desire. I do it. I have certain aspirations for my death. I pray about it regularly. So, you know, if we can do like that. I guess those of us who have, I've been declared clinically dead. I've had a number of experiences of very close calls to death, and I was once declared dead. So like Tusti, I can understand, you know, there's a certain sense of urgency, and there's a greater concern for the issue when you've been that close to death. And you've experienced, that's what actually brought me to Krishna consciousness. Because when I read fifth canto, what happens at death, I thought, yeah, that's what happened. this is exactly what happened. I can relate, you know, every verse in purport, I can relate, yeah, that's exactly what I went through. So convince me that this book knows what it's talking about. So, you know, but if let's cut the conversation now. It's just been interesting to see how different people feel about things. But if we can, we do have a lot to say about our own destiny. How we desire has a lot to say with how we'll meet things like death. So we can pray. We can also pray for other devotees. No, both don't. The one who falls down after a short time, he's the person who is still got a lot of material desires to deal with. So he will go to the heavenly planets. He will go to the heavenly planets. Krishna will give him facility to fulfill those desires. And then he'll come back and be born again into a position that's favorable for Krishna consciousness. But somebody who has actually been practicing a long time and gone past those grosser desires, material desire, that kind of desire is quite gross. So they've gone past that, but there still may be other difficulties that are there. Misconceptions, like really deep-rooted anattas. You know, we even find that, for example, you can't compare the fall down of, you know, Bhakta Joe, who's been in the movement 5 months, and some guru who's been like dedicated to the movement for 30 years and falls. Like with Bhakta Joe, it's just that his senses and mind are sort of pulling him. He hasn't been practicing very long, so he'll be dragged by his mind and senses. But usually you find with people who've been practicing for a long time, there's something existential. There's some essential misconception, or, you know, there's something very root about what they're dealing with. It's not a superficial thing, and usually it's not to do with this lifetime. Usually the anattas are not to do, you know, we're going back further. Because we're clearing. I don't know, you may be a bit young in Krishna consciousness to experience this, but I'm sure some of us who've been around for a lot longer, you get a feeling that we hold on to this body, you know. But the subtle body, we drop so many, isn't it? We're completely different than when we join. We're very completely different than what we were 5 years ago, 2 years ago. So we're constantly dropping these. What does that mean? That we're peeling off layers and layers of birds of contamination. So we're not dealing so much with the anattas, the situation that goes with this lifetime. We've already started to work back through other lifetimes, other circumstances. So it's a lot deeper rooted anattas that we're dealing with there. That's how I understand it. Does anyone have other insight on these verses? But, you know, someone who goes to the heavenly planets, that means they still have a desire for gross sense enjoyment, because that's what Swarga Loka is all about. You know, good wine, good women. It's basically where it's at. So, you know, that means that they're still dealing with gross anattas. They haven't come to anything subtle yet. But then, you know, when they get into the higher practices, they may even have the misconception that they're a guru, or the misconception that they're a Vaishnav. These are very subtle misconceptions. We are never a Vaishnav or a guru. You know? We're a servant of the servant of the servant. So this is very, very subtle. Very, very difficult to deal with. Yeah. Again, this is... Here we're looking at the last paragraph of the purport to 29. Where Prabhupada says, while in the material energy the living entity serves the material senses, while in spiritual energy he serves the Supreme Lord directly. In either case, the living entity is a servant of God. This vision of equality is perfect in a person in Krishna consciousness. So here it's a matter of level of consciousness also. We had this experience another time. That here we're talking Uttama, the consciousness of an Uttama Bhakta. He doesn't see anybody not engaged in Krishna consciousness except himself, because he sees everything as Krishna's energy. He only sees two things, Krishna and Krishna's energies. So those who are engaged in the material energy, he sees as being engaged in Krishna's service, and those who are engaged in the spiritual energy, he sees the same way. But for us it's a little difficult to understand, because it's a very high level of consciousness. It's one beyond intelligence and mind. They've been dissolved quite some time back. So, you know, where we've still got this material mind and intelligence, a little bit hard to relate to. But that's basically what we're talking here. We're talking the vision of an Uttama. It's very high. Is that okay? But that's... we have to remember that this is not a preacher's vision. This is Uttama. Question is, well, maybe then we have a license to please our senses, material senses. But here we're looking at a very high level of vision. Doesn't give us scope. There are a lot of other verses in Bhagavatam that say that. Okay.